All right. Thank you, Jeff. Before I get started, I want to mention I do have an ulterior motive for being here this week, or at least in addition to the cocktails that they give me at night. And that's actually, we have a graduate program at Suffolk University with a focus on free market economics within the PhD program. And one of the reasons I come here is to meet students who are interested in grad school and try to recruit you so that you come there. So if you haven't had a chance to talk to me privately yet, I encourage you to talk to me at cocktail hour tonight about it, or to shoot me an email afterwards, and I'll send you some follow-up material on it. It's very mainstream core in the first year, but then when you go to the fields, there's some free market guys there who you can do work with. Small program, incoming class is usually between 6 and 10 students. This year, half of the incoming class are libertarians that I recruited, and I like to keep it that way there every year. My topic for today now is Somalia and what's happened there since state collapse. And I'm pleased to give it here this week because of all the other lectures you've already had. You've had Walter talking about privatizing roads and oceans, Stringham doing a version of market chosen law. You've heard Brian talk about less than minimal. Even Team Germany got in on the action with some privatization of police. So this might not sound like as radical a talk as when I usually give it, because it's fairly limited, and I'm talking about statelessness in Somalia, really in the context of African development, not directly on some of the topics that you've been hitting so far on debates about that for here. Audiences, though, even this one probably, has a lot of misconceptions about Somalia. When you hear Somalia, what do you think of?
Disaster.
What? Orderless. Chaos.
Edible napkins.
Okay. All napkins are edible. I'm just not sure if they're nutritious. I'll have to learn about the Somali ones, I guess. I didn't encounter that in my research. Oh, I get it. He said, have you ever been to a Somali restaurant? And yeah, what they serve is UN food packets. Actually, they don't. And that's really the point of this talk, is actually, it's not all of these things that pop into your head when you hear Somalia. Most Americans, at least, have some version of Black Hawk Down, either the book or the movie that they saw of everybody warring there, the population being very poor. But really, while that was an episode since their state collapsed, it's not the norm that their society has had for most of this time. So I'd like to talk a bit about how they've developed economically and what are the institutions that have provided some form of order there in absence of a state. So some background on this: Somalia and the Horn of Africa is composed of two parts, really, the northern part that was colonized by the British, Somaliland, and the southern part that was colonized by the Italians. In the 1960s, they got their independence, and the politicians drew some lines on maps again and said, okay, this is the nation of Somalia now. You have a government. And funny thing about constitutions, you can write them for someone, but you can't actually export the enforcement of them. So they gave them a Western-style constitution and say, you're going to have a democracy here, and it didn't stick. Within a few years, a dictator had come to power and ruled the country until 1991, when the state eventually collapsed. When that happened, and this is where most U.S. knowledge of Somalia comes from, is in the early 90s, with the collapse of the state, the warlords and various clan factions immediately plunged the society into a kind of brutal war of all against all, trying to take power and become the new central government. And it makes sense if you really think about, within Somalia's context, but also a lot of other African nations, their entire experience with a nation state has been with a particularly nasty one. For all of the ways that our own state here oppresses us and brutalizes us, it's nothing compared to what's done to a lot of them there. First, they had colonialism, where it comes in, resource extraction, then you're given a modern government. One clan comes to power, extracts wealth from all of the others for the benefit of itself. Now it collapses. The expectation has to be, this is exactly what's going to happen to me again. Well, I want my clan and my friends to be the ones who run the government, because I'd much rather be on the receiving end than on the giving end of this. So they all start fighting with each other. And this is when the U.S. comes in, and the U.N., for their, quote, humanitarian interventions. I always find it interesting that we use the word humanitarian when we send people in with guns. During this time, and this is where the conflict between the Somalis and the U.S. happens, and the Black Hawk Down incident occurs, and the U.S. eventually decides to withdraw. Funny thing happens, though, and this is usually where U.S. people stop updating their information about Somalia. They just assume that they go on continuing to plunder and kill each other. Once the U.S. left, the prospect of having a new central government there diminished. And once it did, the clans stopped fighting with each other. There was decentralized skirmishing and some fights, but nothing like widespread civil war like there was when they expected that they'd have a new state. And while they were relatively peaceful, they start finding other ways to solve disputes and actually getting a bit of economic growth. Now, that doesn't mean there haven't been flare-ups again of the violence, but it's been mostly focused around different attempts to impose a new government on them. There's been multiple governments in exile that have been created, and each time one of them goes into Somalia, all of a sudden the fighting starts all over again of different factions wanting to be in control of that government or them all throwing it out, basically saying, we don't want your government. I'll get a little bit later to the most recent attempt that's still not done yet. But they've thrown out all of these so far. The last one's been around for about a year now and really doesn't have that greater control yet, so I assume it will, at least I hope, once I show you some of the other stuff here, that it too will wither away and get kicked out. They do have two so-called states, in the north, Somaliland, and then towards the east, Puntland, that call themselves states. What I'm going to talk about in Somalia today, I'm going to be talking about the entire region, both the north and the south. And it's really because the northern part is just like the southern part. If actually, guys, give me a definition. What does it take to be a state? What are the characteristics of something being a state? Yeah. Monopoly of force. In a given territory. Yeah. That's it? Huh?
Sovereignty.
Sovereignty.
Or a claim to the justification of that monopoly.
A claim to the justification of that monopoly, sure. What?
A standing army,
possibly.
Autonomy to act.
Autonomy to act.
Like independent of other states.
Independent of other states. Okay, I guess.
Legitimize.
Some degree of legitimacy that the people view it as their state. I'm hearing from the other crowd over there. Often you also think of them of having some monopoly, not just on the ultimate use of violence, but also of providing the settlement of disputes and then using the monopoly of violence to enforce those decisions. These states have none of those characteristics. They are not the ultimate monopoly in the area. They're not viewed as legitimate states for their people. They don't settle disputes. They don't provide security services. What the hell are they? Well, they're like they created a little government on paper and said, we now have a government. And what they're hoping to get is recognition in the international community, because once you get that, then aid money can come in. And when aid money comes in, you can steal it. So they've created governments basically as shells where they're hoping to get recognized so that they can steal some of this money. They don't actually provide services to their people. They do collect a little bit of tax revenue, but it's very, very small, like on the order of $1 per capita per year. So really, they don't steal much more than common bandits as opposed to monopolized bandits. So I don't think they have the characteristics of the state that we'd think of at all, really. And when I talk about how disputes are settled in Somalia, how security is provided, all of these things that I talk about are as true in the north as they are in the south. In fact, most of my description of Somali law comes from a firsthand account in the north. So while they are supposedly states, I don't think it's useful to think of them as that way. We can think of all of Somalia really as statelessness, at least when it comes to providing internal order. So it's a kind of interesting place to look at for a variety of reasons. One is kind of a theoretical testing ground between different views of what statelessness is like. You have the traditional Hobbesian view picked up by Buchanan and Olson in economics of life's going to be nasty, brutish, and short in the state of nature. Buchanan did kind of what I'd call a priori history on this and saying, well, this is how it must be. I don't actually have to look at how people behave in a state of nature. And finding that they're always going to have conflict with each other and plunder each other, and it's going to get the nasty, brutish, and short outcome. Other people, like David Friedman, Murray Rothbard, and others, have theorized that private companies can evolve to provide most of the services that the state could, and that would provide internal order to society. What goes on in Somalia certainly does not correspond perfectly to the Rothbard-Friedman view, but it's even farther from the Buchanan-Olson-Hobbesian view. Order is provided. It's not some libertarian, anarcho-capitalist utopia. But it does do relatively good at providing order compared to realistic alternatives, which is really the perspective I take for this talk and in the paper I wrote on it. Basically, comparative institutional analysis. Given the level of wealth there, given the culture, given the inherited cultural and physical capital that they've inherited, what are the likelihoods of the types of institutional arrangements that they could create to order themselves? And how does Somali statelessness compare to Somali state and compare to other neighboring African states, given these realistic alternatives of what they're like? Whenever you compare an ideal to a reality, the ideal always looks better. Here, we're going to try to compare reality to reality. Given the type of states that emerge in Africa and in Somalia, how does statelessness do there compared to it? That doesn't mean that's how the West would do with a similar system. It's just talking about, within their context, how well is it functioning. So first, a little bit of background of how they were performing with the state. They first adopted what they were calling scientific socialism. I'm not sure how scientific it is, but I'm also not really sure how socialist it is. It was more of a ploy to get military aid from the Soviet Union, which they were getting up until they went to a war with another Soviet satellite, Ethiopia. Then they got cut off and suddenly abandoned their socialism. But their policies actually didn't really change in this time. They were doing the same thing before and afterwards. A lot of what they did was land nationalization and land redistribution, in particular to try to break up groups of the population that were rival to the government. They wanted them relocated and scattered to other parts of the country. They also wanted more of the better land to go to the ruling clan. Public good provision. Now, this first part you might look at and say, well, that doesn't sound all that bad. 1988-89, one of the last years they had government, 90% of all government spending was on defense and administration. Some of you might think, all right, well, there's all these things the government does that they shouldn't do, but maybe national defense is the one thing I think is a public good and a government should do, so it's good that that's what they're spending all their money on. It's kind of a problem, though. Somalia's not at war with anybody at this time. It's spending on defense to defend the government from its people. Not exactly what I think of as a public good, probably a public bad. Spending on social services from them, less than 1% of GDP. And big wealth transfer. Basically, the rural pastoral sector creates most of the wealth in Somalia. About two-thirds of all GDP that's produced comes from that sector. They got less than 6% of government spending. It was basically a transfer away from the rural areas into Mogadishu, the capital in particular, to get money for the ruling elite. The black market there did pretty much everything. It employed most of the labor by the mid-1980s. And it's not like just drug running and things that you'd think of as black market activities in the U.S. I mean, it's providing essential services, banking, finance, dispute settlement, health, education. These are all black market activities in Somalia during this time. So what you're dealing with here is not some semi-limited government, some bloated welfare state in the West. You're dealing with a state that is what George Aidi refers to, and I think all states to one degree or another are this, but Aidi refers to these as vampire states. They suck the lifeblood out of the economy. And that's really what's going on in Somalia in this time. So when it hits its statelessness, there is some disorder and fighting that occurs. But once that settles down, the bar that they need to recover to, given what was going on before, isn't that high. So we need to kind of separate this out into different periods. The post-91 warring, while is the new expectation that there's going to be a new government, just like the old, but different people will run it. I want to run it. That's where all the fighting's occurring. Then, and this is where most of my research focused, is 95 to 2006. There are a few governments in exile at this time that try to come in. There's a quick violent conflict. They're thrown out. For the most part, they're peaceful during this time. There's various clans throughout Somalia, and they're not really warring with each other. They're coexisting and commingling, actually, and settling their disputes and being able to generate some economic growth is what I'm going to show you. Then more recently, 2006, we have another intervention, another government in exile, and it comes into Somalia, and actually I can show you where. First into Badoa here is where they came in because they couldn't go to the old capital, Mogadishu. And while they come in, they don't have much force, and the Somali population does not support them. Instead, they're actually resisting them. The Ethiopians actually backed the government coming in and sent their own forces in to bring this government to the people of Somalia. Little bit of problem doing this. Ethiopia is their long-hated neighbor. This feels a lot like a foreign invasion, sticking a foreign-backed government in charge of us when we really don't want one. So the population revolts against this and fights. Here's what's problematic. What happens here is instead of just the decentralized warfare that had happened before, there became a focal point of where the resistance was going to be. And it was what was called the Islamic Courts movement, if you saw that on TV at all, because the U.S. had a little bit of a spat about supposedly Al-Qaeda terrorists being involved with the Islamic Courts movement. Islamic courts were not big in Somalia prior to this. They basically did divorce and inheritance law. Most of law was outside of them. But it was the group that was opposing this government in exile coming in. They were the main focal point for the fighting against them, and clans rallied behind and supported it. And in the process, what happened, at least around Mogadishu, is you got a de facto government of the Council of Islamic Courts, and it was a particularly nasty government itself. In fact, it started trying to impose Islamic law on the city. The two groups fought. Council of Islamic Courts was eventually defeated. The government in exile, the transitional federal government, has come into Mogadishu and somewhat taken control of Mogadishu. It doesn't control the rest of the countryside. And people are still fighting against it in a decentralized manner. It doesn't seem particularly likely that the government's going to be able to expand its control over much of the rest of the country, but it might be able to control the old capital for a while. That's kind of where they stand now. I don't have new statistics on Somalia and how they're doing during this time. I imagine it's probably not very well because there's been a lot more fighting going on with this, but interesting to note, it's not an internal dynamic of criminals trying to take over that causes the big civil war. Each time it's external states backing a government, trying to bring it in and impose people who are already doing their own order, that flares up the fighting. And in this case, actually flared up a de facto government that emerged fighting against it. So with that in mind, I want to look and say, how are these different sectors doing now? So the first one, and probably the least surprising, is look at the rural pastoral section. And there's an economic anthropologist, Peter Little, who did a lot of field work there, and I pulled a lot of his work that he was doing in the late 90s to put into this. Garissa export market is in Kenya, and they find the value of cattle sales there going up 400% over the course of the 1990s, volume quadrupling as well. So export market actually increasing during this time of statelessness. Northports, Basasu and Barbera, these are up in Somaliland, exported 95% of all goats, 52% of all sheep from East Africa. It was larger in volume at the end of the 1990s than at any time when Somalia had a government. And this isn't just Somali livestock that's going out overseas. It's actually landlocked countries on the interior of Africa bringing their products in through Somalia and then shipping them out of the ports. So they're getting international trade coming through the country while they're in a period of statelessness. This tells you something about their ability to provide security of property rights and dispute resolution, that they can get goods flowing through them. Why these different sheep did not go from other countries to different ports instead of continuing to go through and actually expand in Somalia. They did have a drought that made them worse off around 2000, but Kenya and the other neighboring East African nations had the same problems. There wasn't anything particularly unique about Somalia during this drought. It's a semi-arid country, and droughts hit, and it's problematic whether you have a state or not. Interestingly, security cost, armed security costs about 1 cent per kilometer per animal that you're herding. Basically, herders would go out and hire private security when they're moving their cattle across the country. And Little did a survey of these guys and found only 26% of traders thought security was a problem at all, and only 13% thought it was any worse than when they had a government. Basically, the government wasn't protecting them anyway. They had to hire their own security then, too. So it's not like all of a sudden with the state collapse, these rural pastoralists no longer had security in what they were doing. They privately hired it and moved on with their activities. And as I'll tell you later, they came up with a rather innovative way to protect their money after they've made their cattle sales when they're going to move back to where they came from. Urban and commercial activity, a little bit harder than the pastoral sector, which survived being repressed by the state. You wouldn't be that surprised that it does okay when the state collapses. Major companies have gone in and made investments in Somalia. Dole Fruit has. Coca-Cola opened a bottling plant outside Mogadishu that produces about 36,000 bottles of Coca-Cola a day. DHL ships there. If you go onto DHL's website, you can arrange a shipment to Somalia without a problem. Affiliates of GM Kenya moved into the country and operate there. BBC and British Airways also have affiliates that operate within Somalia. In fact, BBC is one of the better places to pick up news about Somalia. Take a look at just one city, the city of Borama, and what goes on there. Population in the city varies by season, somewhere between 150 and 300,000 people, because these people are nomadic herders, so depending on the time of year, there are more in the city. You can get statistics actually out of there, how many restaurants, tea shops, and all sorts of different retailers exist in the city. 90 restaurants, 8 of them have international star ratings. You can actually get information on them. In fact, hotels, same thing, there's 16 hotels, 4 have international star ratings. Fuel stations, interestingly, 18 of those, 7 of them with underground fuel tanks, just like you'd go to a gas station out here and it's got underground tanks and pumps. That's an important signal in parts of Africa. If you don't have security in your property rights, you're worried that the government or a private criminal is going to come in and seize it. You don't put a bunch of valuable gasoline in a tank underground that can be seized. Instead, you work out of 55-gallon oil drums or a tanker truck, and you serve from that, so as soon as things are less secure, you can drive on and move away. Here they're making an investment and actually putting the fuel in there. That's signaling that there's some stability of property rights there, that there's some confidence in this. While these things are interesting, I think it's good to go more overall and take a look. What's the big picture of living standards there? How are most of the people affected? And one guy, a colleague of mine and Ed's from when we were in grad school, Peter Leeson, he got interested at this about the same time I did. In fact, it was when Ed and I were interviewing people in New Orleans for a job at San Jose State, and we had some boring candidates that I started looking online while they were coming through, and there was a small study that came from the World Bank of all places, a little 4-pager on Somalia, and it said in there, Somalia is not doing so bad, actually. It compared a few living standards to neighboring African countries. So it's about the same. Now, these guys weren't libertarians in the least. In fact, they wrote on their blog afterwards, because this took off in the libertarian world, of people saying, look, Somalia's kind of cool. They're like, no, hold on, guys. We didn't really mean that. But that's what their study kind of implied. So it was the first time I was alerted to it. Then it was one of our San Jose State students, actually, who I got working on a research paper on Somalia with. But that's what got it started. Anyway, Leeson got interested about the same time, and he and I have both done studies now looking at how living standards have changed in Somalia. What he does is he puts together old World Health Organization reports from the 80s and from the 2000s, as well as other UN reports, World Bank reports, basically whenever the same report was written twice, and takes a look at, well, what were their standards back then? What are their standards now? And have they improved or not? What he finds out of the 18 of them, 13 of them improved, 2 were clearly worse, 3 were questionable. And it was a couple of the health ones, and in particular education, that got worse. And the education, it's not so much statelessness as it is. They used to get government aid for intergovernmental aid for education. Once their state collapsed, people stopped giving them aid for education. So education rates went down a little bit. Also, by the way, one of the reasons they do poorly on literacy, they didn't have a written language till the 1970s. So it's not all that surprising that not everybody is literate in the country. So I think, well, that's very good. I think a good reply to it might be, well, if other neighboring countries were growing during this time, so what? Somalia improved. That doesn't really tell us that much. It just tells us they didn't collapse. So what I wanted to ask is, how do they do compared to other African states? So I compare them to 42 other sub-Saharan African nations using World Bank World Development Indicators on everyone where I could get consistent data across the different countries, which is problematic in Africa and particularly problematic for Somalia. And here's what we find. So these are the different measures I was able to get. Some of them for 2005, others don't go back farther, but some of them I have to the mid-80s and 1990, just before the state collapsed. So over here on the right-hand side, what you have is their relative ranking compared to the rest of them, and over here you have the absolute standard. So what you find when we first look at just the 2005 column and their rank, in a lot of them, they're kind of middle of the road in terms of these other sub-Saharan African nations where they rank. So there's 42 countries, so anytime you're above 21, say you're in the top half. The death rate, they're at 17, top half. Infant mortality, they're really bad at, towards the bottom of that. But if you look over to the right, they were always towards the bottom of that. It's not like it got a whole lot worse. Life expectancy, 18th, top half of the sample. And in fact, in terms of change in life expectancy, because you see a big improvement on life expectancy over that time, the actual change is positive 7 years in terms of life expectancy. So since going stateless, the average Somali is now expected to live 7 years longer than he was back when he had a government. It's the third biggest improvement in all of Africa during this time period. Child malnutrition, around the top half or so, didn't have earlier data on it. Telephone main lines, way up there on that. They used to not be as good. And when you look at other related ones, household with televisions, internet users, mobile phones, they do really well in all of these. In fact, The Economist magazine reported that a long-distance telephone call in Somalia is cheaper and gets a better signal than anywhere else in Africa. Any ideas why? What?
What's their geography?
Nope, it's not a geography answer, although that's a good one to ask. They do need to communicate, but people need to communicate everywhere.
What?
No regulation. How are phone services provided through much of Africa? Through state monopolies or grants of monopoly privilege to particular countries. You can download the World Bank's Doing Business Index and find out how long it takes to get a telephone line installed in your country in various spots around Africa. And you'll find waiting lists of well over a year in many countries to get a telephone line installed. In Somalia, there's no one to tell you you can't put up a cell phone tower. Everyone sticks them up all over the place. Because of that, the prices are driven down through competition, and you can get a signal anywhere. And this becomes important later, actually, for how they do some of their business. But they've been really good in telecommunications, mostly because African states oppress the telecommunication industry. Here, there's no one to do it, so they're doing relatively okay. Yeah?
Now that you're referring to the communications,
yeah. Are you a Francisco Marroquin student?
Yes.
Awesome. I love your university. I'm a big fan. I've been down twice, and I'm going down again in April. The question was, in Guatemala, and actually some of her professors had a hand in this, they deregulated telecommunications there, and it's since exploded there. I've seen Giancarlo, the president, give a talk on this before. Fantastic example there, where it wasn't abolishing the state, but it was abolishing the state controls on telecommunications, or at least significantly relaxing them, and all of a sudden you got much better service throughout Guatemala. So basically it's similar type of thing going on here, except it's not explicit deregulation, it's just disappearance of all regulation. So talk to me later, by the way. Other things, immunization. They do pretty poorly on this. They're near the bottom, but they were near the bottom before in 1990. Improved water source, same thing, near the bottom, but it's a semi-arid country. Tuberculosis, they've improved slightly, but still bottom half. And should notice, if you think about the trend in these, if you look while it had a state going into statelessness, the trend on almost all of these is going down in the rankings. And then what you see is even where they do poorly now, it's either just perpetually staying there, or you've seen a reversal of trend. It was on a downward path and kind of started turning around actually since this. So one valuable comment a referee gave me, so referees sometimes when you submit papers to journals actually help you, is they wrote, well, interesting, but maybe it's just all the effect of war. So you said Somalia was able to maintain relative peace after it lost its state after the first 5 years. Maybe that's why they improved, because all the other African nations are fighting each other. And at first I said, well, of course, there's some like that. But how big could it really be? So I had to figure out of these 42, how many were continually at peace for the whole time period? Any guesses?
Continually?
Probably none. We have a very pessimistic person. 17. So over half of them had a war at some point during this time. So I separated it out and said, all right, let's compare Somalia just to the peaceful nations. Basically, out of the 17 here, so now you're talking around 8 or 9 is when you're in the top half, you get pretty much the same story. It's the same categories that tend to lag behind, and you still see the relative turnaround in rankings. Slightly less pronounced in a couple of cases, but for the most part, same story going on. But in a sense, the deck is stacked against Somalia in this case, because they did have a war going on for 5 years when the state collapsed. These countries were peaceful during that time. It seems like if we want to do a better job comparing apples to apples, what we should do is look at countries that warred at about the same time as Somalia, but then reestablished states, or monopoly states, because they really had competing ones going on beforehand, and see how they've done relative to Somalia. So there are a few that did that. There's five countries listed down here at the bottom, along with the dates that they actually had their war, which all roughly correspond to about the time that Somalia was fighting. And one of the times I was presenting this in my graduate department, one of my grad students is from Senegal, and he raises his hand and he says, oh, but that was a very, very minor war in Senegal, barely counts. And I said, all right, but that actually kind of makes my case stronger in this, because that means they should be relatively better compared to Somalia, since they were fighting a more major one at that time. So here it's not really useful to think about ranking so much, because with five countries you don't move around too much. But we can look at percent improvement since 1990. And you see in the death rate, Somalia improves more than the other countries. Infant mortality, where they've been having problems, they remain problematic there. Life expectancy, up about 12% compared to the others. Telephone main lines, huge increase compared to the other countries. Immunization rates, these are things that they rank relatively near the bottom in all of the samples. Still, even though they were near the bottom before and they remain near the bottom, in terms of absolute improvement, they actually improved more compared to the group. It's just it wasn't enough to move their rankings in the other ones. TB, they still struggle with. They're doing worse on that. But it seems through any one of these that you use, they're doing relatively okay in statelessness and actually growing more now than when they had a state. AIDS, obviously not a huge problem in Somalia, because otherwise we wouldn't pick up the blip up in life expectancy. To some extent there, but it's not one of the African countries that's really plagued with it. So how do they do this? How do they provide complex goods and services? The first one I don't really think that's complex, but it's just kind of interesting of how they go about providing it. They used to only have one international route and one national carrier when they had a state. Now they have 15 different firms, 60 planes, and 6 international routes. Any idea how they provide airline safety certification? So like I said, it's not some, you know, David Friedman-style utopia here. There's not a private company that certifies them. You got an idea? Make sure the airlines what? Yeah, the airlines themselves do try to make sure that they're safe, but then they try to get certified. The way they do it, yeah. Yeah, basically they fly the plane to another government, and when they're contracted on that route as being safe to fly into that country, they use the same planes inside of Somalia. Basically, they outsource their safety certification. No reason why a company or a good housekeeping seal of approval type thing couldn't emerge in Somalia, but they have an easier alternative right now. Just fly to the other countries. When you're certified by that, you can use it there. Banking and funds transfer. This is really interesting, especially also for libertarian and Austrians who like to talk about money and banking systems and free banking and commodity currencies. First is the Hawala system, is their banking system that moves closer now to $1 billion annually. It used to be closer to $500 million. And it's their funds transfer system. And the way it operates actually is there's no, like, you don't come in and show your Somali driver's license when you go to the bank. There's no one issuing you one of those. In fact, there's no one there telling you you can't drive without a license. What you do when you go to get the money is they'll say, okay, well, we have a series of questions for you, so you have to pass our test. And what happened is whoever sent you the money gives them a series of questions, usually based on family history, that you have to answer to certify who you are. Then you get the money. You can also send money to yourself and set up the questions that you'll have yourself asked when you get there. And this becomes important for them because it's one of the ways they provide security. So you have herders who herd their cattle across pastoral lands, export them overseas, or sell them into the Kenyan market in particular. Now they get paid and they're there, and they got to basically walk home or get transported home with it. Now, somebody could steal your cattle from you, but cattle are kind of problematic to steal when you're herding them because then you have to herd the cattle away. Money, on the other hand, is much easier. So how do they protect themselves? They go, they sell it in, say, Garissa in the Kenyan export market. Then they take the money, they deposit it at a hawala there, transfer it back to theirs over phone, go home without their money, get there, and then take money out. It's one of the ways that they provide security for themselves. What type of currency do they use? Their government collapsed. There's different versions of hawala throughout Africa. In fact, they didn't really have access to the formal banking system before. They were using a version of hawala before this, too. And this, you'll find it in, I was giving this lecture to my class one time, and I had a bunch of actually the Lost Boys from Sudan who go to school at San Jose State. I think I had a dozen of them in my class over a few years. One time they raised their hand, professor, 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 but it's the same thing in Sudan. We have to do that, too. It's basically one of the mechanisms people use to provide some sort of banking when they don't have access to the official system. The actual money that they use there. Interestingly, where's the value of your dollar come from? How do you know what a dollar's worth? What? How much you think it is? And how do you know how much to think it is? How much everybody else thinks it is. We're getting into a kind of problematic area here, aren't we? In fact, what Mises used was the regression theorem when he talks about this, of how you go back and first you had commodities that were exchanged, and then the commodity started acquiring extra value because you trade for it, not just to use it, but because you knew you could re-exchange it, and eventually the exchange value of the commodity becomes much more important than the actual commodity value. And people's expectations of the value is really based on the expectation that other people will re-exchange it. And he talks about how eventually governments divorce the actual commodity from it and people trade the money just on the expectation that others will. So where you get this expectation tends to be what people believed it was worth yesterday, assuming you think they'll also believe something similar tomorrow, and you kind of update all the time. Well, when the Somali government collapsed, they did have a paper currency, the Somali shilling. Its value didn't disappear. People didn't all of a sudden decide, oh, our government's gone, we're no longer going to accept this paper in payment. They continued to accept it in payment. And now competing currencies started coming up, except with an important caveat. This wasn't like Hayek's denationalization of money, where people come and they create their own private currencies that, you know, Ben Bucks versus Ed Bucks or whatever, and then I make mine and I try to keep my inflation rate low so that you'll choose mine instead of Ed's. Here, the different people printing money all printed the same money, Somali shillings. So we were competing for seniorage in the same currency. What would you expect the rate of inflation to look like? Pretty high. How high? There's an answer. Infinite, right? There should be no stealing on the inflation. It's basically a public good every time you don't print extra money. A public good, spillover good to the rest of the other people who are printing money. It's the tragedy of the commons, so you should all deplete it, get an infinite rate of inflation. Doesn't happen in Somalia. Why? Because that expectational value people had for the currency, even though they knew everybody was, quote, counterfeiting the government's already counterfeit money, they knew what the old bills were like. And even though they could tell what a counterfeit was, they wouldn't accept anything bigger than the old denominations. So the old denomination capped out at 1,000 Somali shillings. In the initial rounds of inflation, they'd print 500 shilling and 1,000 shilling notes. Very quickly, inflation started pushing the value of these down, except it costs money to make currency. You have to buy the paper, the ink, and transport it into the country. Well, what they did is they inflated all the way down to basically a commodity currency for Somalia. So Somali currency is 100% commodity-backed in its paper and ink cost. It's literally worth the paper it's printed on, plus transport cost, which is about 4 cents per 1,000 Somali shilling note. Sounds a little silly, but actually, pretty much any quantity of money, within reason, can be optimal. The key is that it's stable so that we can calculate in it. once they inflate it to that level, and they did it fairly quickly, it's a stable price level. They don't have inflation anymore, really. In fact, what you get is mild little bouts of deflation, where as money comes out of circulation because it's worn out, the value starts going up a little bit, but as soon as it does, someone can print some more and make, you know, the extra cent seniorage or whatever. So they bring it in and price level stays there. It's pretty stable. So that's how they provided their currency. Works pretty well. I mean, it's what we want out of a currency. Kind of odd how they've done it, but cool. It's the only instance of this that I know of. I'd be happy if anybody else knows of others where you got this situation that was stable. And the key to it all is there's no government who can keep tacking on zeros to the end of the bills and forcing people to use them. Here, people have to voluntarily use them, and their expectation of its value is tied to the fact that it looks like the same denomination as the old notes. Now, that is problematic for large transactions. If I had had my other PowerPoint with me, my PowerPoint wouldn't open when I went to put it on this morning, so I had to kind of splice together a more academic one for this. But I've got another one with more pictures in it, and it's actually got like a guy holding Somali shilling notes like this and just stacked up his arm. I don't know, he's probably buying a loaf of bread or something. But they can use it as a unit of account pretty well, and they can use it for small-scale transactions. When they want to do bigger purchases, simple. They just use U.S. dollars for the most part. Basically, there's no legal tender laws. You can use whatever currency two people want to transact in. So for the most part, they use U.S. dollars for bigger transactions. But kind of innovative way that they've created their money supply and have it pretty stable. Roads, and I know Walter talked quite a bit about roads the other day, so I won't harp on it too much. I'll just say, empirically, they're producing it without a state, about 3,000 kilometers per 1,000 of population, which if you look at the World Bank databases on this, it's exactly the same as what you get in Kenya and Ethiopia. Same average there. So they seem to be doing, while the roads aren't great, provision at least as well as the states around them. Social insurance. There's been a few mentions of mutual aid societies I heard in discussions here. The way they provide social insurance is through the clan system. You have kind of higher order clans, sub-clans, and then what they'll call dia-paying groups that I'll get into in a second. But basically, you're born into a social insurance group that's both your insurance in the legal system, but also your social insurance if you become unemployed, if you become sick. By custom, you're expected to take care of others who are in your insurance group. So let's talk about these other big ones, security and law, because it's really interesting when we get into the law. The security, and this is how it's provided in some instances, in particular in some cities, but it's really not the dominant form of security in Somalia, but it's to hire people to protect you. The Economist reported, I thought this was interesting, taxes payable to a tenant of local authority or strongman are seldom more than 5%, security another 5%. Hell, a 10% tax rate, that's not too bad. That's better than we do with a lot of our Western governments. So they'll hire armed guards to stand out in front of their stores, and this is something you see in plenty of places that have a government. You also need to hire this other security. Little, in his surveys of the rural area, shows that security costs really haven't increased. They've been about the same as what they were before. And the reason why is a lot of the security is provided through their legal system. They have their own customary legal code called the ZIR with the DIR payment system attached to it. So it's not unlike a lot of other customary legal systems some of you might have read about either in Bruce Benson's work in medieval England or in Iceland. Or in old Ireland, although that one's a little bit different, has a lot of common characteristics with them. Here, the way it works in Somalia is, let's start with a simple example. If we're both members of the same clan and we have a dispute and we want to settle it, we turn to the clan elder and say, here is our dispute, and then he makes a ruling. And whatever he says, we are forced to abide by, and the local community will enforce it. If we go against it, we can be shunned from the community. In fact, my dia paying group, which is usually based on your paternal great-grandfather, everybody from a paternal great-grandfather down is part of the same paying group. If there's a judgment against me and I can't pay it or I refuse, my paying group is responsible to pay it for me. And then they use social norms and sometimes not so nice social norms to extract payment from me later or make me regret the fact that I didn't pay myself. A lot of the enforcement is done voluntarily through this system, basically decentralized enforcement provision. The way the clan elder is chosen is it's not hereditary. It's more custom. Those who are viewed as knowing customs of the society best are the ones that people turn to provide this service. When someone starts making rulings that the citizens or the clan members view as not in accordance with our custom, they stop going to them. They pick a different clan elder to hear their disputes. So it's very voluntary of how they're selected. A little bit more complicated. If now, instead of you and I having a dispute, you and I have a dispute, and I'm a member of one clan, you're a member of a different clan, we both go to our mutual clan heads or clan elders. they get together and talk, and they try to resolve the dispute. And if they make a ruling together, then we're obligated to abide by that, and it goes to the same dia paying system as it would have if we were in the same clan. If they can't agree, what they do is they turn to a third-party clan. Let's say you're a clan elder in a different group. They'll agree to go and talk to you, and whatever you rule will be binding on us. So it comes back to the same dia payment system. It's not hierarchical in this, though. It's not like there's a supreme clan council that it goes up to. It's just because, you know, if she and I are in clans A and B and you're in C, we choose C. It could also be now that, you know, if she and I are in clans A and D, we don't also appeal to C. We might appeal to B or E or anybody else. So each different clan is bilateral of who they'll appeal to, and it doesn't have to be the same one each time either. So it's not setting it up where there's some ultimate monopoly of deciding right and wrong and what the law is here. It's very decentralized. Different clans can have slightly different laws, more than slightly different laws, although they tend to converge. The way the law becomes common throughout the country is through the hearing of disputes and trying to interpret what custom should be, what custom is, and how it should be tweaked in either clan on the margin to make it more uniform. So there's no legislation that's passed anywhere. There's no equivalent even to the old Icelandic all thing where they'd get together and recite the laws of society. Instead, it's the customary norms of each community. And then how you find common customary norms is by having disputes with people outside of your own clan. And then that codifies the law and makes it more consistent between the different clans then. So it's a slow evolutionary process of how they come to have uniform law within the country, which I'll get back to as one of the challenges for them going forward. Interesting things about the Somali one in particular, though. Not only does the community kind of voluntarily choose which clan elders they'll go to, but you're not actually stuck with your clan either. You're free as long as you don't, as long as another clan is willing to accept you, you're free to switch clans, and they do quite often. Sometimes for business reasons, sometimes for political reasons, sometimes for marriage reasons. It's not uncommon for some people to switch multiple times within their lifetime to a different clan group and a different dia paying group, and once they're in there, then they turn to a different elder to hear their disputes. Another interesting feature, it's not geographic monopoly. The clans don't have particular geographic areas that they all control. There's some that tend to be more dominated by one clan than another, but it's a nomadic society and they integrate throughout the country. So it's not decentralized law of different areas of the country each have their own law. It's actually different people subscribe basically to different legal codes of their clan and integrate on the streets or the fields together, even though they have different legal codes. Their appeal process when they have a dispute is slightly different. And then you're free to switch between them. So it's a very voluntary kind of customary legal system. And it's fairly well defined, a lot of it, in terms of what penalties are. First of all, like most customary systems, you find it's restitution based. Once a ruling comes down, you have to try to make your victim whole. Most of the penalties are specified actually livestock, but you can use the monetary equivalent of the livestock instead. And they have it well defined. If you kill a man, it costs you this much. If it's an old man, it costs you less than that. If it's a young person, it might cost you more. If it's a woman, it costs you less. Actually, you don't have as bigger penalties for killing them as you do men. There's a reason for this, for both the old people and the women, because they actually think the economic value when you kill one of the men who's in prime working age is a greater loss to his family and dia paying group, so that group needs to be compensated more than they otherwise would if it's someone who can produce less valuable resources for them. They have it right down to, like, if you cut off someone's ear, how much that costs you. And this is fairly well known and throughout the country, and these are kind of common norms that most of them have. The sanction when you don't abide by things, first of all, is your dia paying group can try to force you to make your payment, or they have to pay for you, and then they start giving you social norms that you might not like. Over time, if you continue to be someone who's a net offender, there's no jail that they put you in Somalia, but they use a practice that many customary legal systems throughout history did, and it's your dia paying group decides, I no longer want to be responsible for you. We're going to declare you no longer part of our group. In fact, you're going to be declared an outlaw. An outlaw has a very specific meaning. You're outside the law. That means if anybody wants to steal from you, kill you, kick you, you know, poke you, whatever, they're free to do it and there'll be no legal repercussions. If you're an outlaw, you cannot live with society. Things go very poorly for you. So you think back to the Robin Hood and his merry men, the outlaws. Why do they live in the Sherwood Forest? They can't live around civilization. They're outlaws. People will go around and poke them, maim them, and steal from them. Same thing happens in Somalia. So this is the type of enforcement that they give. So there's no prisons there for this. If you're declared an outlaw, though, your life's in jeopardy. They did also have Muslim courts. Muslim courts did not do very much in this legal system. They basically, by tradition, they did divorce law and inheritance law. That was it. All the rest of the legal system was from the customary law of Zier. Other big so-called public good, national defense. Well, we could say national defense is a public good, but Somalia kind of just gives you a historic example of, well, we privately provided it. They did kick out like six governments in exile. They kicked out the UN and the US. Now, that's not to say if the US wanted to invade and take over the country, they couldn't, but that's mostly our economy of scale and violence, not something particular about statelessness. Whether Somalia had a state or not, the US could do it if it wanted. The point was they were able to mobilize well enough to throw out six or seven external threats, and they're currently dealing with the latest one, the transitional federal government who's in there. So they've been providing a form of national defense. In fact, we have an expert on partly how they provide it. Jeff Hummel has written a couple articles, including one in Stringham's book on this topic, about the role of ideology in national defense. Why do people do it? It's not for their narrow economic self-interests. In Somalia, when they see an external aggressor coming in and is going to attack their society, it's more for ideological reasons, not their own narrow economic interests, that they rise up and fight against it. And that's common in places other than Somalia as well. So the kind of comparative institutional take I have on Somalia is they do fairly well in this analysis. It succeeds in providing some law and order without a government, and the economy is growing relative to what it was before and relative to the other sub-Saharan African states. So given ideology, culture, resources, Somalia is performing better than when it had a state or equal or better than many of its African neighbors. So this has been pretty specific about Somalia. What are some little bit bigger lessons we can pull out maybe for the rest of Africa that's really having problems in developing? Although I will say I'm a long-term optimist on Africa. I wish my 403B plan at Suffolk had an Africa investment fund. I'd probably put about 10% of my retirement in it. My short-term prospects for most of Africa are very grim, like everybody else's. But what's happened is, as society or the rest of the world has progressed and got richer and richer and Africa has stayed the same, that gap gets bigger and bigger, which means when you get your institutions right, your growth is even more explosive. So this is why it takes the US and Great Britain 200 years of industrial revolution to make the transformation. You look at the East Asian tigers, there's so much more wealth, capital in the world, they get their institutions right. They can do it in a period of a couple generations. You look at India, China now, 10% growth rates. Africa keeps lagging behind. When they get it right, they're going to be explosive. I'm not interested in like Chinese investment funds. Everybody already is optimistic about them, and they bought Africa. Everybody's pessimistic on, but when they get it right, they're going to be explosive. So I would diversify. And
yeah, but you just told a bunch of libertarians.
You guys aren't big enough to swing the market on this, I don't think. I have the general interest at heart, at least among this room. I want you to all be wealthy and become donors to FEE. How's that? So what are some lessons for some of these other African countries, though? Customary law is not unique to Somalia. Most African countries have some form of traditional customary law in them. They're not all as good as Somalia's, I don't think. Many of them are more hereditary-based and probably less competitive. I was giving this talk last week at an IHS seminar, and a couple lectures before me, a guy from Zimbabwe gave a talk. And he mentioned during his talk, you can't go to the government courts to enforce your contracts. You can't trust them. So in the Q&A afterwards, I mentioned, well, how do you resolve disputes there? He says, oh, our tribal dispute resolution system. Like, and we started talking about the details of it. And it's different than Somalia. It shares a lot of common characteristics, but a little bit different. But this type of customary law exists many places, if not most, in Africa. And it existed, the Somali one existed during colonialism. Just the British didn't interact with it. The Somalis used it to order their own activity. The British extracted resources and sent things overseas. Later, the formal African nation state of Somalia did the external interaction but still ignored the population. They used the system. And this is true in most of the other countries. So we need to distinguish kind of between what modern Africa and traditional Africa. A lot of traditional Africa is what sustains the population that's there now, both in terms of the institutions that allow them to order their activities and the actual economic prosperity that they can generate to the extent they do often comes from this sector. Where instead you also have this supposedly modern sector that's imposed and funded externally and mostly exists for the ruling elite and their interactions with the West. Much of the effort that the West makes trying to, quote, develop Africa is through this modern sector, either giving it aid or trying to prop it up, trying to transport Western institutions where they weren't and say, all right, here's your government, this is your model, now you'll do it in Africa. And it doesn't stick. Constitutions don't enforce themselves. Ultimately, it's ideology of the people that binds politicians to follow the rules of the game they create. And if you create these external institutions that are not consistent with the underlying norms of society and their traditional systems, it doesn't stick, and you get these nasty outcomes that you're getting all over Africa. I think instead the effort needs to be made to encourage these other customary systems to develop more. George Aidi actually he's a native of Ghana, an economist at American University, And he wrote the Africa chapter in this excellent book that I'd encourage you all to buy that's out on the table. And he has a very provocative line in there, at least for most audiences. The rogue African nation state should be left to the fate it deserves, implosion and state collapse. And you hear this and it sounds, oh my God, that's awful. He's advocating chaos for Africa. What I'm telling you is actually Somalia experienced this, implosion and state collapse. It doesn't mean chaos. It means those traditional institutions that ordered most of their activity start coming to the fore and actually doing better than they could when they were just in the background, and the oppressive regime over it is gone. I think it's not a utopia for Africa, but I think it's a better starting place, at least in many of the countries, than what they're doing right now. The real challenge is to line up the informal norms with the formal institutions in those societies. I will say one place where to some extent they've done this while having a government is Botswana. The person who came to power there was a traditional tribal leader, and they incorporated both their traditional tribal law and British common law together to get a relatively limited government system that has, well, it's expanded, but kind of more on a trajectory like the U.S. expands. It hasn't been like a radical overthrow of the institutions there. And from the mid-1960s to the mid-1990s, they were the fastest growing country in the world. Bet you didn't know that. And that was before they found diamonds. Much of that was before they found diamonds. In fact, the finding of diamonds is probably a negative for them, because the government steals a lot of the diamond revenue, and it's allowed the government to grow bigger than it had been before. The real challenge for them is to evolve customary law. So the customary law that they have is not perfect. In fact, when you think about it, it's an evolutionary process that creates it. But for the most part, it happened in pre-industrialization and internet and globalization. It does pretty well with ordering internal activities among the Somalis. When the British came in, they handled all the external affairs through colonialism. The Somali law never evolved to deal with that. Same when the Somali nation state came in. Now, here they have customary law, and what they're having a hard time with it is integrating outsiders. There was a guy, Frank Van Noten, he passed away, but he was living in Somali land. And he had actually married into one of the families there and was trying to find ways to modernize Somali customary law to integrate outsiders more. He had ideas for free ports and integrating them through clans. But it's hard for foreign businessmen sometimes to do deals in Somalia because of the customary legal system there. I think it's something, given time, the Somali legal system will evolve to take care of it. They have an incentive to. But because it's been in the background for so long, it never evolved this before. I think it's true probably of many of the decentralized systems throughout Africa. What we, in quotation marks, in the West can do, I think rule number one has to be first, do no harm. When we actively give aid to governments there, we enhance the political sphere at the expense of the private. That misdirects entrepreneurship, and it locks in existing political equilibria. I think it's probably not controversial to say that existing political equilibria in Africa are inefficient. And they're making the populations worse off, both violating their rights and keeping them poor. I think it's good if those break. That means cutting off aid flows to them and letting the modern sector implode if that's where it's headed towards. I don't think we can actually go in and do it for them and say, all right, here, we've got rid of your government, now set up your informal rules. I don't think it works too well when we impose it from the outside. I think it has to be more bottom up, which means getting them culture, ideology, beliefs of shedding their nation states and trying to grow these institutions in something, into something that can support a more liberal society. That's the battle of ideas. Partly migration flows help. In fact, I met an entrepreneur last week who lives here in the U.S. but is from Zimbabwe. And one thing he does, instead of donating money to an African government, is he buys books on liberty and he sends them to schools throughout the country to try to spread these ideas. Another thing, there's evidence that when you trade with nations, if you're a more free economic nation and you trade with a less free nation, the less free one tends to improve freedom over time. A colleague of mine called it contagious capitalism. These are things that on the margin I think we can do to help, but mostly it has to be their own process that evolves the law into something more liberal and that can order the societies more. So at this point I'll open it up for questions for you on Somalia and this stuff, or for that matter African development generally. Yeah. I don't know. It's possible that the clans would just fight over the natural resources. The economists call this the natural resource curse. If you want to see a movie about it, go watch Blood Diamond, right? All it is natural resource curse. There's one big diamond. Everybody spends the whole movie running around trying to get the diamond, and no one actually makes anything for anybody. The only part of the movie that didn't happen that I was predicting was I thought Leonardo DiCaprio would, like, kiss somebody on a boat while it was going underwater. They never got that into that movie. But I don't know. I think the natural resource curse can be problematic, but it's certainly not determinative. There's plenty of societies that have tons of natural resources that don't spend all their time fighting over and do quite well. So it's an empirical question of how often it tips you that way versus not. I'm not convinced that it would necessarily make them go that way. I think the more key thing is that they had this underlying customary law already in place to fall back on right away. Yeah?
I think of longevity a little bit. It's been more than 10 years now, and now we're going to go through something again. Do they not have the educational foundation being able to uphold it?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's the educational foundation. I mean, they want to, at least by interpretation of everything I've read, they want to uphold it from the inside. The problem is the external influences that come in and say, you don't have a state, you need a state. Where is your government? You can't be a real people without a real government. And then we try to stick them with one, and that's when the fighting comes up. So I think longevity is an issue, and I'm not that long-term optimistic on it because states are going to continue to meddle with them, and eventually they'll probably make one take hold. But internally, it seems to be ordering it fairly well. It's not devolving in terms of, rival clan factions all colluding all of a sudden and becoming a government. That's not happening. They're not warring with each other. It's the external influences that I think are the problem long term.
What external influences? You mentioned that they're not getting
Oh, yeah, I mean, mostly attempts to create a new government and then give it to them. So some Somalis who are outside of the country will come, they'll form a government in exile, the UN will back it, the UN will send some troops, or the council, or the some other African nations, Ethiopia was the most recent, will give them some troops, bring that government in and say, all right, here's your new government. And that's when the fighting all pops up. And eventually one of these efforts is probably going to be successful. Yeah? No, I would like to have. So 2006 is when I was working on some of this research. And that's also when this latest attempt to install a new government went in. So that's when all of the fighting started. In particular, the Council of Islamic Courts movement became bigger. So I was in Kenya about a year and a half ago, and one of the thoughts going on that trip was maybe I can go over to Somalia while I'm there, but it was right in the middle of actually a bunch of the fighting that was going on. So that didn't work out so hot.
And the second question, have you seen that we should stop sending aid to Somalia?
Well, we've already kind of stopped sending aid to Somalia. I meant stop sending it to other places. We've pretty much already stopped sending it to Somalia. I meant we should stop sending it to other African countries, too.
In Somalia, as I know, more than 1 million people depend on the aid that they receive from UN, especially rice.
So there's different aid programs we could talk about. Food aid has its own kind of perverse things that go on where you destroy local markets and they became dependent upon food aid. Once you get so much food aid, no one has an incentive to make the food there. Then, of course, when you take away the food aid, they're all poor and starved because we already destroyed their incentive to make the food before. There's going to be transitions cost to doing that. Maybe you need to phase out the food aid and do it slowly so the local markets recover as you're doing it. If there's an intermediate step for that particular program. Yeah?
What about pirates?
Yeah, there was a report of this recently, right? Where a cruise ship went by the Somali coast and some pirates went out and actually shot some shells at the cruise ship. And they wanted to try to take it over and steal from everybody there. Somali customary law has nothing that says you can't go out and pirate other people who aren't. Do I think it helps their national defense? No, I think it hurts their national defense because it pisses off other countries, which makes them think more like, I want my own criminals to control that country. We'll call it a state. And then they'll stop their criminals from messing with us. But in terms of the internal law and order, the piracy is not affecting that. It's more people who get together and go say, let's mess with people who aren't part of the legal system where there's no repercussions. And I think this is also part of Somali law integrating with the rest of society, outside world as well, but it hasn't addressed this yet. Maybe it will better in the future. Yeah? I don't know if treating like outlaws is the right description. No, I don't think so. But mostly people I've talked to are kind of sponsored when they're there by someone who's, they don't quote adopt you, but you're there kind of under their protection and their legal system, and that's how you operate. It could be as informal as you're staying at a hotel and therefore if someone has a dispute with you, they'd appeal to the hotel owner. But it's not like all of a sudden you're an American and you show up, they're going to shoot you. But it does make it difficult to do business transactions or something like that. Yeah?
I'm just curious, what do you
I have no idea about child rights, except that the payment for killing children varies. It's not exactly the same as killing adults. I don't know what their rights, what children's rights are. It's actually hard to estimate because it's a nomadic population. They haven't done a census in a while. So one statistic you cannot get for Somalia is per capita GDP. And it's not so much that they won't estimate a GDP, it's that they don't estimate a per capita, so they don't know what to divide by. Yeah. Can you speak up, please? The punitive system is largely restitution based.
So when do they ever kill or use capital punishment?
Yeah, if you become an outlaw, you can have capital punishment used against you. No, that is part of the legal system, though. I mean, once you declare him an outlaw, you're essentially saying it's okay to go ahead and do this to him. Go ahead and enforce your own right or get your retribution how you feel. I'm not aware of anything in the legal code that says, all right, there, you can now go ahead and, you know, poke out his eye because he poked out yours. You don't typically find this in customary legal systems because there's a net deadweight loss to that. Instead, there's no deadweight loss to the transfer, and you get better off. Yeah? Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Your clan might eventually throw you out and say, we don't care even if you are paying. But that actually would tell me that just means their customary payments aren't high enough if they really want to avoid those crimes. They should raise the payment. Or it might be efficient, actually, in a form of ex post contractual agreement that, all right, if Bill Gates really digs poking people, he can go around and poke people and keep paying them, and it's gains from trade if they don't start raising the fines. Friedman's got a section in Law's Order, I think, where he talks about this. Why he doesn't think the wealth effect is particularly relevant for this, at least in terms of efficiency reasons. Yeah? Presumably, if the payments are set at the rate that the community views the harm of as actually being caused, you shouldn't be worried that someone's going to give a harm to you because you actually won't suffer a harm. You'll get restitution that exactly equals it. And you can factor in if you want to say, yeah, but it's the fear of being harmed. Okay, add in an extra penalty, throw in another camel for fear of being harmed.
And they don't have to inflation rate adjust the penalties.
And you don't have to inflation rate adjust the penalties, thank you. Yeah.
What type of immigration rate is there out of Somalia? Because I know there is a significant small population in the United States.
Yeah, in particular the Midwest and also in Minnesota in particular, like Canada, but also Britain has significant chunks of the population there. We don't have, at least I don't know of out-migration rate statistics for them. A lot of it already happened in the early 1990s when everything for 5 years was going to hell in a handbasket. I can't tell you what the current rates are because I don't know of anybody who collects them. But those stats that I had up there are basically the only ones that I could get from an international source on Somalia, like where they're consistent with other country sources. So data availability is very limited for Somalia, in part because there's no government who wants to run around and collect it. Instead, people just go about their daily business. So maybe it's a good thing that we can't get these stats. Yeah?
Are they a member of the UN? Who would pick the person that would be a member of the UN and representative of the UN? And do they have passports? And how do they keep other people from coming in and out?
They don't really keep other people from coming in and out. In fact, actually, on a lot of maps, mine actually had a line there. A lot of them just make like a fuzzy colored thing on the border between Somalia, Ethiopia, because there is no real border there. No one pays any attention to it. People roam across both sides of it all the time, so they don't have any sort of border control. What was the other part of the question? Oh, they don't have a representative to the UN. They're not recognized. I always think this is kind of interesting, states recognizing each other. What you look at them like, oh, I recognize you. You look like Somalia. since they don't have a state, other states refuse to recognize them. Yeah. Oh, when the Ethiopian soldiers come in, people get pissed off and they start shooting at them. So it's not that they have a law and like a checkpoint that says, oh, Ethiopian soldiers, not allowed. It's like when you come across and you have machine guns and one of those, you know, maybe the light blue helmets, it's a pretty good indication that that's a person we want to shoot at and keep out of our country. And they've done it successfully a number of times. They're currently dealing with the one that's in there right now.
So if they don't have passports, can they come to the United States?
I don't know. know how they deal with coming to the United States on passports.
Our government
asked for them.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't think refugee programs, generally you have to have a passport, though, because they recognize that a lot of refugees are just running away from governments who wouldn't have given them a passport to leave anyway. So I don't think in principle, I understand, like, usually to travel to the U.S. you need one of these, but I can't imagine that they typically make it a requirement that you must have it for refugees, because it seems to me that a lot of refugees fleeing governments wouldn't have passports from that government anyway. Yeah, you could. I mean, I don't know if the U.S. would let you in or not. Again, not a problem of internal ordering in Somalia, though. A problem of U.S. foreign policy messing with people over there who make them want to come blow us up. And Somalia rightly saying, hey, we're not part of enforcing U.S. policy. We're just trying to govern our own activities. And by the way, you know we're pretty poor and we have a lot of governing of our own activities to do. I don't really think U.S. security is their concern in the least. They were a little bit concerned indirectly during the Council of Islamic Courts movement because there were supposedly a couple of al-Qaeda's involved in that, more than a couple of al-Qaeda's involved in that. And once there were, then the U.S. started talking about giving missile aid or other military aid to the group going in to kill them. And then Somalis got more interested in making sure some of those people weren't around. Yeah.
Do we know what the religious makeup is there?
Mostly Muslim. Yeah.
A quick quote from the British anarchist Colin Moore. Anarchy is the cement that holds society together. And I thought this was a good observation.
Quote from who?
Colin Ward.
Colin Ward. Anarchy is the cement that holds society together. And interestingly, apparently in the Somalian example, this is kind of saying it was the cement that was already holding them together. Once you got rid of the guy with the sledgehammer hitting the cement stayed together a little better. On that note, I thank you all for listening and look forward to talking to you later.